It's the show on KJZZ. Along with our partners from the world, we'll keep you up to date this hour with national and international news, along with stories from Metro Phoenix and Arizona.
A new program in southern Arizona uses art to help LGBTQ kids see themselves as they are and their spaces as they could be. It's called Mapping Q, and it's run in conjunction with the U of A Art Museum and Southern Arizona AIDS Foundation's Ally Suicide Prevention Program. Sarah Bonson is a suicide prevention specialist with the program and says most of the participants were between 16 and 20 years old. Bonson says part of the goal was to make them feel comfortable both in a museum and on campus, but also within themselves.
Mapping Q was a special event series that was put on between my Ally program and the University of Arizona's Museum of Art. And the curriculum started off using the Ally curriculum, which is a suicide prevention-based curriculum focusing on positive messaging and sources of strength so that we don't have to look to suicide as an answer during challenging times. We worked with the university's Museum of Art with a woman named Chelsea Farrar, who had created her own curriculum that looked at mapping spaces and focusing on teaching LGBTQ youth and other at-risk youth about heteronormativity and how particular identities are not necessarily reflected in every space that you might visit. And they were asked at the end of it to create an art project based on what their ideal space would look like. And so we had 11 tremendous art projects that are now displayed at the museum through January 4th.
When you talk about mapping spaces, for listeners who might not really understand what that means, can you define those terms?
For our purposes, when we took a field trip to the Museum of Art, and the youth were asked just to look around the space and to see what they noticed in terms of gender and sexual identities, any other identities that were important to them. And they had a little sheet of paper that had each gallery on it, and they just indicated what they noticed for all of those things. And then we got together and we talked about what they noticed. And then we talked about identities that they didn't notice or didn't feel were represented. And the more they started talking, the more they realized that they didn't see a whole lot of queer representation or LGBTQ representation. And they wanted to change that.
Do they not see representation in the art itself or in the way that the museum was laid out?
In both. So they were asked to map whatever they noticed in the space. So not just the art, but the art was definitely available and noticeable. But in gendered bathrooms, even. When we gender bathrooms, girl and boy, male and female, man and woman, then we're leaving out identities. We're leaving out transgender identities. We're leaving out transmasculine, transfeminine, gender neutral folks, gender queer folks. There are a lot of identities that are not represented in just gendering bathrooms.
What kinds of art projects did the students end up doing? What did some of them look like?
We had a range, and they were all wonderful. One of my favorite pieces started out, it just looked like kind of a bunch of rectangles on top that were different colored, but as your eyes kind of fall down the page, the lines start to droop and bend in ways that make the piece really askew, and I'm not going to do justice to the artist's interpretation, but it's basically a commentary on heteronormative boxes and queer spaces. So they're on the top, these perfect boxes that, you know, make sense. And then as you go down the page, it just gets a little bit more queer. The boxes don't quite work out the way you think they will.
What do you hope that the students who took part in this program took away from it and will carry with them?
One of the things that I hope they take away with is that they belong, is that even when their identities aren't reflected back to them in the world, that doesn't mean that they don't belong. And I hope that they find within themselves the strength to say that my identity is valuable and that maybe it's not valued by everybody, but that doesn't mean that I'm not valuable. That just means that I need to work a little bit to change the world.
Sarah Bonson is a suicide prevention specialist with the Southern Arizona AIDS Foundation's Ally program.
Mark, there was an old joke that went something like this. Why are there gates and fences around the cemetery?
I don't know, Steve. Do tell.
Well, because people were dying to get in.
Ugh.
But more Arizonans are now choosing cremation, which means there are fewer traditional burials and less concern about there being enough available real estate. David Long is president of the Arizona Funeral, Cemetery, and Cremation Association.
We are ranked fifth in the nation as far as cremation is concerned. when we see Arizona, about 70% of the families that pass away in Arizona are starting to lean towards the cremation trend. I know that in speaking with other specialists in the field, they don't foresee any sort of depletion of land or cause for scarcity until very, very far in the future.
Well, I'm intrigued by the idea that there's a trend toward cremation. Are there obvious reasons for that or reasons we wouldn't have thought of?
Well, there's actually both. As far as the more obvious reasons, of course, in today's economic society, there is, of course, concern for costs. With growing costs for traditional funeral, as it were, earthen burial, many families have chosen cremation, which typically is much more economical for families. However, it can be just as expensive, if not more expensive, than traditional earthen burial, dependent on what is chosen. When we look at Arizona, one of the things that I talk to many families about is the fact that we are such a mobile society, and even in Arizona, I myself am not an Arizona native. Most people that we see are moving from the Midwest or maybe California or even from up north or out of country. So we see a lot of transplants. Additionally, when you look at the median age of our residents here, as it is getting a little bit younger, we still do see a lot of senior citizens, and many of them, not only have they moved away from their local home residence where many family members and friends are, but they tend to have enjoyed a longer lifespan and have really outlived many of their family members and friends, so they're not seeing necessarily a cause for the traditional funeral and are opting for cremation. So that would be another reason.
Do you anticipate other changes coming as the baby boomer generation, as more people from that generation expire? How could that affect the industry?
Well, we are actually already starting to see that with our baby boomers, whether it be from them starting to pass away or thinking about their own mortality and making arrangements in advance for their services. We're seeing that baby boomers today, their age bracket is very tuned into what services are available within the funeral and cemetery profession. They have more access available to them via internet and other resources. So they're really choosing what they wish to have. So we're seeing a lot more personalization within services, a lot more customization, not necessarily changing what their ideals are about burial or cremation per se, but as far as the type of service that they are wishing to have. They're becoming much more involved. It's something that they're more openly ready to talk about rather than, say, their parents or even the generation before that. Because, of course, the subject of death is still very taboo. But with our baby boomers, we're seeing that they're more open to the idea of letting their family members know what exactly they want when it is their time to pass. They're wanting more than a well-conducted funeral service. They're really wanting that personalization. But it is a little bit hard to say because, of course, depending on demographics, where they live, the cultural background, there are still those that cling to tradition and keep those funeral services just as they were for their parents and their parents before them. Again, with the baby boomers, we do see that they are trying to incorporate more personalization, more modernization, things as far as webcasted services, internet memorial archives, DVD videos, things of those sorts.
David Long is president of the Arizona Funeral, Cemetery, and Cremation Association. It's the show on KJZZ, a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and stories from around the country. With help from our partners at The World, today we're mixing news and stories from our community and the globe to keep you up to date and entertained. Good afternoon. It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. Happy holidays.
This afternoon, along with our partners at The World, we're keeping you connected with stories from Phoenix and around the globe. Earlier this month, members of the Navajo Nation went to a Paris auction house, outbid a French art collector, and bought seven masks for about $9,000. Objects of cultural significance to the Hopi tribe were also available at that same auction, but representatives declined to travel or bid. For more on the issue of cultural repatriation, we turn to James Ridingen, an associate professor of American Indian Studies at ASU. I asked him how decisions are made about how to try to get items back.
Decisions come from within the tribal context. There's probably a lot of discussion that goes on between the elected political officials and the religious officials, the religious people. So the dynamics would probably differ somewhat from Indian nation to Indian nation, just depending on on the structure and how much the religion remains intact. That and also resources. I'm sure that this would be a factor in determining whether a nation wanted to go forward with a repatriation process that costs some money to retain one of their cultural items. And some Indian nations are in better shape financially than others. So there's a lot of factors that would come into play in that, making that determination.
Have there been approaches that have proven more successful over time?
Well, you know, what we're talking about here in this particular case is the international repatriation, which is substantially more difficult than domestic domestication. In the United States, we have the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990, and also the National Museum of the American Indian Act of 1989 that provides avenues for Indian nations to repatriate cultural items in museums and federal agencies. So it's a lot easier. There's a process done that has been established, that many Indian nations are very comfortable using these days, and repatriation has been fairly successful. International repatriation is substantially more complicated because, of course, NAGPRA and the National Museum of the American Indian Act only apply to the United States. So you have to have a cooperation or willingness to cooperate amongst these foreign entities.
This is obviously not just an issue for American Indian tribes, but ancient cultures and people all over the world. I'm curious if there are similarities and differences between, as you say, museums holding on to items from one group of people versus holding on to items and trying to get them back for American Indian nations.
Yeah, there would be similarities between American Indian repatriation efforts and those of non-Indians around the world. Oftentimes, these items have been taken from one country and placed in another, and those countries that are holding those items do not want to give them up for whatever reason. So there are some similarities that occur. And when we talk this language of repatriation about sacred items, we're not talking about art history or artwork. You know, we're talking about sacred items that have spiritual meaning, that are oftentimes seen as living entities. And these items were often taken during a period of extreme duress when federal policy was trying to stamp out Indian culture.
Given that, at least in the U.S., there are laws that govern cultural items, how big of a market is that versus what folks are selling not at auction houses and maybe that aren't in museums that groups of people can try to get back?
There's a black market that has thrived in this country and also the international arena where many items from Indian graves are dug up and sold, including human remains. So it's a situation that in this country anyways, the laws will provide some protection to try to stop those sale of those items that were stolen from graves. But, you know, the law is not totally comprehensive. There's a lot of loopholes in it that enables people to get around these situations. But there's a lot of grave disruptions that continue to go on because that black market fuels those activities.
James Ridingen is an associate professor of American Indian Studies at ASU.
Captain America, Spider-Man, the Hulk, you might have seen them on the big screen or maybe in comic book panels delivering heroic punches and witty puns.
Ever wish you could jump in and join them? KJZZ's Annika Klein stepped inside the Marvel Experience, a traveling exhibition making its debut in Phoenix that puts you at the center of a Marvel story.
Welcome. You're now entering the SHIELD Mobile Command Center. Your briefing will begin momentarily.
I'm with a large group of people walking into the Marvel Universe, where we're greeted by a bunch of familiar faces. Thor, Wolverine, Black Widow, and they need our help for a change. Our mission? Take down a villainous organization called Hydra.
Without the help of recruits like you, survival cannot be guaranteed.
Now, we're agents in training. There's a 3D shooting game and an Avengers encounter. Here's one of my fellow trainees, Katie Peterson, explaining it.
You do the pose and it summons the superhero next to you. And my favorite superhero is Hulk.
Once we complete our training, it's on to the next phase.
Welcome to the SHIELD Simularium, a cutting-edge virtual reality environment.
The only problem is the virtual reality simulation isn't working quite right today. It's in 2D, not 3D. Early visitors to the Marvel experience have taken to Yelp and other social media to complain about glitches like this and long waits. Doug Scher is the co-founder of Hero Ventures, a company that helped develop the experience. He says the issues are now fixed and the Marvel experience is still improving.
This is a preview, but I don't want anybody to feel like guinea pigs. Virtually everything is still up and running in a great experience. It's simply better when everything is the way we intended it to be.
At the end of the day, despite the malfunctions, we did defeat Hydra in a 4D motion theater. And I became a full-fledged Marvel agent. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein, now officially a superhero.
You can have your own Marvel experience through January 3rd.
That's how many people have served as governor of Arizona since it became a state in 1912. Doug Ducey will be sworn in as the 23rd governor next week.
But in the last quarter century, the face of the office has changed quite a bit. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez explains.
Arizona has had 13 Democratic governors and 9 Republicans. Some have served 2 and even 3 terms. Most of our state leaders have been men. But did you know Arizona is the first state to have 4 women governors?
The first one, Mofford, Anne Napolitano, Democrat.
Alice Duckworth is with the Arizona Capitol Museum.
Jane Hull, she was a Republican. Jan Brewer, Republican.
In 1988, Rose Mofford ascended to the position after her predecessor Evan Meekum was impeached. Nearly 10 years later, Jane Hull becomes the second woman to take Arizona's highest office. She got the job after Fife Symington resigned. Hull later ran for a full term and became the first woman officially elected governor. But she was not the only woman making history in the state at that time.
But this is a special day because for the first time in the history of anywhere, the top executive positions are all held by women.
1998 was the year of the Fabulous Five. Hull is governor. Betsy Bayless is elected Secretary of State. Janet Napolitano becomes Attorney General. Carol Springer, Treasurer. And Lisa Graham Keegan as Superintendent of Public Instruction. Duckworth shows me memorabilia from this special day.
A signed invitation to the inauguration. So we have all of the ladies have signed it.
Duckworth says she remembers the inauguration vividly. She was there. So was yet another Arizona woman who once made U.S. history, swearing the Fabulous Five into office at the state capitol.
All of them are there with Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve in the U.S. Supreme Court. What a day.
Then in 2002, Arizona elected Janet Napolitano, our third female governor. She made Arizona history again when she won a second term. Napolitano resigned to join President Obama's cabinet as the first woman appointed to Homeland Security Secretary. And that brings us to today. Jan Brewer is the fourth woman elected governor and the third consecutive woman in the state's top job. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things or know things that you think we ought to know, let us know. The show at KJZZ.org.